political levers to compel social and economic change regarding the use of fossil fuels and overall energy consumption may be better pulled far away from international conferences on climate change, like the one there in Doha. History suggests that the slow, accelerating, but steady focus on certain economic pressure points can eventually change minds, change policies, and possibly raise the profile of the moral debate over the use of fossil fuels. Students and other environmental activists in the U.S. have embraced a tried and true strategy to pressure companies and institutions on climate change, demanding that universities divest their endowment holdings in fossil fuel companies. The move against pollution and global warming is a replay of the South African divestment movement of the 1980s, when activists pushed colleges and other institutions to drop stocks of companies doing business in South Africa under apartheid. Some small institutions like Unity College in Maine were quick to get out of fossil fuels in response to this campaign. But on the other hand, Harvard, which has the largest endowment in the nation at $31 billion, basically ignored a recent student vote in favor of the school divesting from its holdings in coal, oil, and gas. Joining us now are Bill McKibben, author and co-founder of 350.org, a grassroots organization working on a version of the divestment campaign. Welcome back to the show, Bill.
Always good to be with you, John.
And Ken Redd is with us, Director of Research and Policy at the National Association of College and University Business Officers. Ken, thanks for joining us.
Well, hello, and thank you for having me.
Now, Ken, when activists start to target university endowments, do you believe that that is an appropriate use of a sort of political pressure to change the political debate on something like climate change?
Before I answer that, if I could just take a quick second to set a little bit of context. So our organization collects information from about 800 endowments, and about $400 billion in assets is what those endowments hold. Roughly 5% of that would be classified as energy and natural resource investments. So roughly $20 billion of the $400 billion is what we're talking about. The analogy to what was done in South Africa is interesting because one of the reasons why that movement was successful was that there were substitutes. So if a organization decided they didn't want to invest in a South African company, they could find another company in, say, the Middle East or something like that didn't have apartheid. So that was the way they were able to get around that.
And you're dealing with strategic minerals in South Africa, so gold and diamonds and strategic minerals, there were alternatives in places like Russia and elsewhere, as you described. Ken Redd, hold on there for just a moment. Bill McKibben, is that 5% $20 billion endowment asset what you and some others are targeting here?
Yes, and it's, in fact, turning into a just burgeoning, mushrooming movement. At the beginning of the fall, there were about a dozen campuses around the country where this was an active issue. As of yesterday, we have 153 campuses. We just came back from a month-long tour of the United States, a kind of roadshow that sold out every single evening in big concert halls across the country, because there are people desperate to go to work on climate change, understand post-Sandy, post-drought, post-Arctic melt, that we no longer have any room to fool around, and who know who the adversary is. The fossil fuel industry has done everything it can to disinform about the science, to delay change, and it's just no longer okay for our universities, which is where we learned about these things, to be profiting from that climate wreckage.
Does the targeting the stock endowment create more of a sting than actually reducing consumption, which actually would have an impact on the environment? Maybe these universities should reduce their carbon footprint rather than focusing on the endowment.
Yes, and many universities are. There's about 700 signed up to go carbon neutral over the next few decades. But if you're going to green the campus, why wouldn't you green the portfolio at the same time? It's all part of the same operation. And in this case, you know, this is a terrifically powerful step, not just for its, you know, sort of direct economic sting, but because it allows everyone to understand that this has become a moral issue. We need to do to the fossil fuel industry at this point what happened to the tobacco industry, say, a decade ago, when, you know, there was a time when Philip Morris was a perfectly respectable company, and then enough people figured out that they were, you know, killing off people one by one. that they weren't so respectable anymore, and the laws around tobacco and things changed fast. You know, the big fossil fuel guys are taking out they're taking out the whole planet all at once. The math is daunting. They have five times as much carbon in their reserves as the most conservative government on Earth thinks would be safe to burn, but they will burn it unless we change the script here.
Ken Redd, I know we didn't ask you on the program to debate Bill on the question of fossil fuel policy, but in terms of the endowments and universities, what's your response to this movement should it grow?
Sure. I don't want to debate the merits of the issue, but just to sort of set a context. So I mentioned the $20 billion figure, roughly speaking, that endowments hold in direct energy investments. A lot of those investments are what's termed as illiquid, meaning that they're not easy to sell. A lot of the institutions are in long-term energy exploration type contracts, which are extremely expensive to break. The analogy to a tobacco company is not quite right, because a tobacco stock you can sell on the open market. An energy futures contract is not something easily sold. It's something that institutions have to fund or agree to fund for a 5 or 10 year period. And to break those contracts for any school such as Harvard, Yale, Stanford would potentially mean hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars lost.
All right, guys, we've got to go to a break here, but Bill McKibben, environmentalist, author, and co-founder of 350.org, a grassroots organization against global warming and pollution. Ken Redd, director of research and policy analysis at the National Association of College and University Business Officers. But these are precisely the issues that students and university officials are debating in this question of divestment of resources in fossil fuel as a response to climate change. Ken and Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Later on in the program, we'll be talking about eccentric family members. You got any? We want to know. Do you have a black sheep in your family?
Diane, I'm calling from Lyndhurst, New Jersey. Back in 1979, I had finished college, and I had 25 first cousins, many older than me. I was the first one to leave home without being married, and it was a big slap in the face for my father, as he told me, and my mom cried for a month. So I think for a long time I was definitely the black sheep, but I don't think I'm the black sheep anymore.
Come on home there, Diane. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to weigh in on this conversation or anything else you hear. Coming up 20 years after the Oslo Accords, no peace between the Israelis and Palestinians. What does a negotiator say?
Two states for two peoples is the solution and has always been the solution.
That's what he argued on behalf of the Israelis 20 years ago. That's Dr. Ron Pundak, who will be with us next on The Takeaway.